You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Marine Corps reservist Stephen Funk surrendered to the military yesterday after refusing to report to active duty. The young man has declared himself a conscientious objector to war. We spoke with his mother, Gloria Pachis, earlier today.
Prior to his deciding to join, I felt that he was just without direction, and he was feeling just a sense of disconnectedness with, you know, he was living away from home. He had spent 1 year at USC, and then because he was dissatisfied with that situation, he quit. So he was out of school, away from family, dissatisfied with his life, and, you know, economically, he wasn't in the best shape. It was things like that that was going on.
Trying to find himself.
Yes.
Some people might argue that, well, he joined the military and he should have known what he was getting into. Have you thought about that? What is your response to that?
Well, I think thinking back to when I was in my 20s is a lot of things people do during that time. They're wanting to find some sort of empowerment or some sort of sense of belonging, especially. Before he joined, I sensed that this was what he was going through.
When did you find out that your son wanted to get out of the military? Had he been writing you?
Well, little by little, I could see from the time he started boot camp that his emails he sent me and letters, I sensed growing dissatisfaction with the military, with the way it's run, how it's run, you know, the mind games they play on people.
What kind of things was he writing to you about?
They just turn you into a fighting machine, I think one of his letters said, you know, to ensure that the soldiers do what they're told on command. And they can't very well do that if they think on their own. And Steve was just fighting it because I brought him up to be otherwise.
What motherly advice did you give him when he told you that he was preparing to file for CO status?
I completely agreed. He had even asked me, he was going, Mom, what do you think? And I'm going, I am completely behind you. I'm totally proud of what you're doing, that you're reversing a mistake instead of prolonging it or making it worse.
Is it that he is opposed to killing or carrying a weapon, or is it the whole military culture that you spoke of before?
It is the culture as well as the killing. He had scored excellent as a marksman in the military, and he had asked superior officers for his score. He was not given his score. Then this officer said that he might have scored high, but on the battlefield, he would never make it as a military guy. He would never be able to kill. And then in Steve's mind, he told me that, you know, that's right. I don't think I could. And I really do think it was that was the turning point for Steve, that at that point he said, I can't kill.
Gloria Pachis. Stephen Funk is not the only service member who is opposed to war. Since September 11th, the number of conscientious objectors inquiries has quadrupled. That's according to Teresa Panapinto, GI Rights Program Coordinator for the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors. She spoke with Peace Watch earlier today.
Members of every branch of the military from every part of the country, including many GIs who are stationed overseas, are contacting us in droves because they are realizing their objections to war.
Well, we don't have a draft. So if these individuals are seeking to declare themselves conscientious objectors, it strikes me as a little bit odd. They volunteered to be in the service.
You know, while technically there's no draft right now, there is something in place that has been for several years that we refer to as the poverty draft or economic conscription. And what that means is that military recruiters go into poor communities, either poor rural communities or poor inner cities, and have billions of dollars in their recruiting budget to convince young people that the only means by which they can achieve an education, get any sort of job skills training, et cetera, is by joining the military. It is presented to them as the only option to get out of their community and better themselves, as it were. So, of course, there's no misunderstanding as to how it could be that all of these people who signed up for scholarship, for college, basically, are all of a sudden being faced with something, and then these issues of conscience are confronting them smack dab in the face.
I mean, you do understand, or you're supposed to understand it if you sign up for the military, that although you may not want to have to go to war or expect that that's what's going to happen, especially when you sign up during peacetime, it is pretty much understood that if there's a war, you're supposed to go.
But it's something that isn't understood by all people. We'd be here all night long regaling you with tales of recruiter lies. But there are thousands of GIs who are told things by their recruiters like, don't worry, there's a no-war clause in your contract.
Mm.
Oh, you're a conscientious objector? That's okay. We'll make sure you don't have to do weapons training. The lies go on and on and on. Even when you look at members of the reserves or the National Guard, most of them join that as a means of an extra income. It's, you know, 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks a year, no big deal. Recruiters never tell those people that when there are deployments, those are usually the first people to go. There are recruiters who, in particular, target Latina and Latino youth and pitch this to them as a means of gaining citizenship. In fact, the military has lowered their English language requirements. So you're looking at even some people who don't speak English fluently, don't fully understand what they're getting themselves into, and then all of a sudden, they're the ones dying on the front line.
So what are the reasons that these individuals are giving for wanting to declare themselves conscientious objectors?
So reasons for conscientious objection?
Yes.
They have really varied greatly. The government definition of a conscientious objector is one who's opposed to participation in all wars in any form based on religious, ethical, or moral beliefs. Taking that into account, there are several people who claim their conscientious objection based on religious background, and that's really run the gamut from Wiccans, you know, white witchcraft, as it were, to Muslims, Jews, and Christians, Buddhists, etc. There are several people who fall into that category. There are other people who simply have a strong sense of morals, and after going through this training, you know, these kind of combat training scenarios, have realized that it's wrong. They cannot do it. They cannot participate in it. So the reasons really vary greatly. And one of the things that we have been seeing, unlike the first Gulf War, where many COs were denied the right to discharge and were indeed shipped, you know, to the Gulf region, the military has actually been processing CO claims faster than they ever have before.
What do you attribute that to?
Well, you know, there could be any one of a number of reasons for that, but what we tend to think is, since there seems to be such strong anti-war sentiment in this country as it is, that if the military were to deny that right to GIs, there would be a very strong public outcry. And that's kind of not what the government or the military needs right now, is even more criticism of their actions. So it seems to be that their modus operandi has been, let's work quickly and quietly and get these people out of here.
What are the penalties, or what is the process when an individual declares themselves a CO? Or seeks the status to be
right.
declared a CO.
Right. So first and foremost, I think it's important to point out that there are no penalties involved. And the only penalties that may be involved is if someone decides to refuse an order, goes AWOL or UA, you know, refuses to deploy, et cetera, like is the case with Stephen Funk. And that, you know, is something that the GI Rights Hotline supports as well. While legally speaking, we don't recommend anyone does that, there are several COs who feel that they cannot participate in the process at all and refuse orders. So that's where the penalties come into play. But for those who decide not to do that, what the process entails is the following. The GI needs to fill out an application that includes 6 essay questions. The essay questions attest to the kind of nature, depth, and sincerity of the person's beliefs, how they were formed, when the change occurred, kind of, you know, whatever evidence the person can put in there to prove they're sincere in their beliefs. In addition to that, the GI is strongly encouraged to submit letters of support from friends, family members, you know, coworkers within the military, et cetera. After that point, the GI has to go through 3 interviews with a chaplain, a psychiatrist, and an investigating officer. And it's after all of those steps have been completed that the investigating officer makes a decision. And generally speaking, this is an honorable discharge.
And so are you required at that point to serve in a capacity where you would not have to hold a weapon or kill anybody or defend yourself?
No. What happens is there are two CO types. There are two types of CO statuses that one can have in the military. So one is requesting a complete and total discharge from the military because your beliefs are so strong that you cannot even participate in this war fight, you know, war machine organism. And then there are others who request to remain in the military, but in a non-weapons handling position. Here at the GI Rights Hotline, we have had virtually no cases of COs wanting to remain in the military, yet not be in a weapons handling position. So that's something that's very rare.
Okay. Any final thoughts on your part, Teresa?
You know, just want to let anyone out there who is a member of the military or who has a friend or family member who's a member of the military to encourage them to call the GI Rights Hotline, and that number is 1-800-FYI-95-GI. Our website is www.girights.org.
Teresa Panapinto with the GI Rights Hotline. Among the voices of dissent joining the chorus of those opposed to the war is Edward Said, professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University and one of the leading voices in the U.S. of the Palestinian cause. John Wiener of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles recently spoke with Said about the unpopular war, the motivations of the Bush administration, and the absence of dissenting or non-Western voices in the mainstream media.
I feel that most people don't are not convinced by the rhetoric of the administration and are convinced that this is a war serving other purposes than the stated one, which is to disarm Saddam Hussein. I mean, on almost any count that you can consider, there's certainly no doubt at all that Saddam Hussein is a tyrant. He's very unpopular. He's done despicable things. But that he's a threat to anyone, well, if you remember, it started out that he wasn't even a threat to his neighbors, who were mostly fat sheikhdoms in the Gulf, including Kuwait. Now he turns into the threat to all mankind, and I think it's the sense that most people have everywhere, that this is a war being foisted on the world with unforeseen and uncountable ramifications all over the world for the sort of tired economies of the major industrial countries, the whole question of democracy in countries like the United States and France and elsewhere. Do they listen? Does the people count for anything? Is this a war, as a lot of people feel, done by a cabal of special interests and highly secretive planning? And, you know, things like bringing democracy to the Middle East and rewriting the map and redoing this, that, and the other thing are all part of an imperial rhetoric that I think the world has grown tired of after the Age of Empire ended, you know, in the middle of the last century.
I wanted to ask what you thought the motivation of the Bush administration is. You know, we hear a lot that the oil is the motivation, but in some ways the current situation is fine for the world's oil companies. They have high oil prices. Certainly the Saudis are happy with the current high oil prices. What do you see as the motivation of the Bush administration here?
Well, I think it's a number of things. I think oil is certainly very, very important. I mean, if Iraq was the world's largest exporter of oranges, there wouldn't be this fuss.
Okay.
No, I mean, I think, you know, but I mean, on the other hand, there is the problem of oil supply for the world and the control of it. I think that's what the issue is.
Yes.
I mean, China, by the end of this decade, will be consuming as much oil as the United States. And if the United States can control the area from the Gulf to the top of the Caspian Sea, that is pretty reassuring, considering that by that time, or by the end of the second decade, we'll be importing 75% of our oil consumption from abroad, and mostly from that area. So that's one factor. Another factor, I think, is Israel. There's no question that of all the Arab countries, the most credible as a threat to Israel in the long run, I mean, if it is a threat, is Iraq. Iraq has natural resources. It has water, oil. It has a sophisticated middle class, an infrastructure, a modern infrastructure built by Saddam with the cooperation of, you know, the West generally in the 70s and the 80s, mostly the 80s. It's a nationalist country, has historically been, and it's seen as, you know, potentially a counter to total Israeli hegemony over the Arab world and the Middle East. So I think that's a factor. I don't think one can discount the dreams of empire and the dreams of providential missions, such as animate George Bush's imagination, and those of the people around him in the Pentagon and the White House, who are schemers and fixers and people who have who thrive on theory and have had no real experience of the world that they're about to enter. And I think also 9/11 plays a very important role, that this is part of the war on terrorism, and we're getting back at these Arabs and these Muslims and so on and so forth. Well, that's a fairly complicated set of reasons.
No,
I think there are probably others as well. I mean, including, for example, the use of military hardware that's been developed over the last 10 years and needs to be tried again, you know, that the war is a kind of laboratory. And, you know, world domination, I think, is probably at the heart of everything here.
You know, in the I also want to make sure we have a chance to talk here about the media, what the American media are covering, what they're not covering.
Yeah.
I noticed that the New York Times ran an article a couple of days ago about a zoo on the West Bank where the animals are dying, where the zebras were tear-gassed and the giraffe keeled over and died.
Well, I mean, you know, I think the Times has done better than most in the sense that, you know, first of all, it hasn't been as supportive of the war as the Washington Post, for example.
That's right.
And there's been some more thoughtful coverage. But, I mean, I think it's still geared to the general viewpoint of the military and the strategic in the United States, you know, that you know, the world has to be seen through this perspective because it's the one that counts. But where the real disgrace of the media is, I think, today, is television. I've never seen anything quite like it. I mean, I just sit there when I don't watch it too often, but I sit there with my mouth hanging open as I watch these CNN, I think is the worst, the commentators, the anchor people, sitting there basically drumming up support for the war with the most outrageously provocative questions, total absence of anybody who might provide a critical and dissenting voice that isn't American. I mean, you know, I mean, a white American. America's made up of many different kinds of people. I mean, why you never see African Americans on, who are likely to be very affected by the war, given the parlous state of the economy. You never see an Arab or Muslim voice on CNN. Charlie Rose has nobody on there but, you know, Hawks and Kissinger and the normal run of the people who people his show. So I think that we're getting a very, very, very skewed and unbalanced look at the world we're in.
I also wanted to think just for a minute about this anti-war movement, an international movement bigger than anything we've seen in the 20th century.
Yes.
What kind of potential, what kind of limitations do you see?
Well, I think it's the, let's just stick with the potential for the moment, because I think it's the future of democracy is there. I mean, what's happened in America is a failure of democracy, where, in effect, a small band of people can literally hijack the country and send it off into a ruinous war with the Congress just more or less looking on, playing the most passive and stupid role imaginable. And the only action that seems to get any attention is mass action on the streets, people blocking, and I think it'll rise. You know, the progress of war to make it seem as if it isn't inevitable. And I think those kinds of institutions are where the hope lies. I don't think they lie in mere elections. I mean, Saddam Hussein has elections. And here, in order to win a big election, a senatorial or mayoral race in a big city, you have to spend $30, $40, $50, $60 million. And we know about the scandal of the last presidential election. So I think there's a turning of a corner there, which is it's difficult to predict what's going to take place, but I think it's a very hopeful sign that people want to participate and want a voice in the direction of their affairs.
Professor Edward Said, professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University, speaking with KPFK's John Wiener. This story was produced by Fidel Rodriguez from KPFK in Los Angeles. 50,000 high school and college students surrounded the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday, demanding the high court uphold affirmative action in the University of Michigan case, and that what they call the war on black and brown people Stop. Addressing 2,000 people at Howard University on Monday, Rosa Clemente, an Afro-Puerto Rican hip-hop activist, made the links between the struggle for affirmative action, racism, and the war on Iraq in her call for freedom.
Tonight, I am making a hip-hop call for freedom. Let me tell you, the Washington Times ain't going to carry this. New York Times ain't going to carry this. Why? Because they're embedded. They're in bed with the military right now and in bed with this government. So the only source of media is going to be Pacifica Foundation, WPFW out here, WBAI, KPFK, and KPFA. I'm making a hip-hop call for freedom. Look to alternative sources of media. Don't even look to MTV, who's owned by Viacom, owned by General Electric, with CBS, who won't even let anti-war videos or to talk about affirmative action on their thing. This is ridiculous. Don't be looking at no mainstream media for the news. And I say that as a trained journalist. I say that as someone who knows war. In 1898, the United States came to Puerto Rico to liberate us. Yet, as a colony 104 years later, we can't even vote for a president like in D.C. But we're good enough to fight their wars. As my people in Vieques, Puerto Rico are test bombed so real bombs can drop on the people of Iraq, I am making a warrior hip-hop call for freedom. I don't say peace. Peace is the absence of conflict. African and indigenous people have never been at peace since white invaders came to the continent and dispersed us all over the world. Hence the African diaspora. We have never seen freedom, as Sister Sada Shakur, who's in Cuba, says. People are talking about going to the courts. This is a country that can't even say that slavery was a crime against humanity. So how are we going to expect the court to save us? We got to think. We got to have vision. And as the hip-hop nation and generation, we got to consistently be very real. And with all our wonderful ancestors in our history, the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement that allowed for a civil rights movement, groups like the Black Panther Party, the Black Liberation Army, the Young Lords Party, the Chicanos, the Brown Berets, hide nothing from the masses of our people, tell no lies, expose lies wherever they are told, mask no difficulties, mistakes, or failures, claim no easy victories. I'm part of People's Army, and I'm Matulu M1's manager and Fred Hampton Jr., are real warriors and soldiers. As a scholar, activist, an organizer, and member of the Malcolm X grassroots movement, as a trained journalist, I'm making a hip-hop call for freedom. As a product of affirmative action, I could live in a nice house, drive a nice car, work for J.P. Morgan, but I choose not the capitalism of America, as the dollar is never going to set anybody ass free, or Michael Jordan and them cats be free right now, which they're not. I choose to live in the hood of Flatbush, Brooklyn. I choose to forgo the nice bubbles, trinkets, receptions, luxury livelihood that I could have via a Cornell degree. I choose the people. I choose the people as my leader, the streets as my office. And I choose the overwhelming love and resistance of my people. I choose to stand on the shoulders of people like Nat Turner, Denmark Vesey, Marcus Garvey, Don Pedro Albizu Campos, Ida B. Wells Barnett, and political prisoners like Jalil Muntakim, Matulu Shakur, and Mumia Abu-Jamal. Those are the troops and soldiers I want to bring home. So save affirmative action in defense of our elders and ancestors. As a Black Puerto Rican woman, because remember, Blackness is not synonymous to African American. My people got off in Puerto Rico and some people got off in Jamaica. That's the only difference. And we got to make that very clear, because they are using Hispanic to put a wedge between us. I'm not Hispanic. My descendants are African. I am an African. I am a Black Puerto Rican woman. Educated in the best schools of Westchester County, in the best State University system where President H. Patrick Swagger was my president, and it was through his policies that I was allowed to set foot at the University of Albany. Educated with a master's in professional studies at Cornell University. I only say this because sometimes people say she can't be educated the way she's coming across. I am very well educated and trained in this system. That's the only reason I bring up these degrees that on the streets mean nothing. Because when the popo stop me, they don't care if I got a Cornell degree or not. Save affirmative action in defense of our history. I'm making a hip-hop call for freedom. A hip-hop call that would unleash the wrath of people's power. That's what we need, y'all. We need the power of the people, not institutions. And if we have institutions, they must be institutions that we build. We must educate. What we need to do, if they strike this down, go on a general strike against this country. Do not go to work. Do not send your kids to school. Do not ride their buses. Do not drive their buses or anything like that. I feel we're very united. We're united if we want to go to parties. We're united if we want to buy Fat Farm and Echo. We're united if we want to listen to the radio. We just have to get united for the right reasons, for the reasons for the people. We have to unite to impeach a fictitious president that was selected, who went from serial killer in Texas to mass murderer in Iraq. Whether we are struggling for affirmative action against the massacre in Iraq or Palestine, the freedom of political prisoners and prisoners of war, let us make a call for freedom. Let us walk like soldiers. We are sisters and brothers. No more peace. What's up? It's about freedom, revolution, political education, physical strength. And lastly, we must become the greatest superpower this world will ever see, the superpower called the power of the people. Resist, struggle, free the land, free all political prisoners, demand reparations, impeach George Bush, save affirmative action in the courts, take affirmative action for your people. My hip-hop call for freedom. Freedom.
Rosa Clemente. Thanks to Reem Kadhuta, Peace Watch producer from WPFW Pacifica Station in Washington, D.C., for that segment.
He's telling me the reason behind the colors that you fly. He's telling me the reason you want us to unify. You say you're sorry. There is no other choice. But how can you feel sorry when you kill people with no voice?
Michael Franti, Bomb the World to Pieces. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Keith Chalgian, Bentha Berklin, and Mike Aloney. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit pacifica.org and make a pledge. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening. Military.